it being past the hour of 2:15 and there being at least three committee members, more than that, in the room, we'll begin the hearing at this time, continuing with the auditor's report. And we're going on to Ms. Ferkel, the deputy legislative auditor, who will take us on. Jim, do you want to make any comments when we start?
Madam Chair and members, I just want to again say thank you for taking time in your busy schedules to consider the work of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We feel very much as partners with you in legislative oversight and accountability for legacy money. And as I said last time, it's very important that we deliver on that to the public. And you, of course, are going to make the big decisions about where that money is allocated and to what kinds of projects and organizations. But we will be with you as you have issues and concerns about how the money is being spent. Is it being spent as you designated in state law, in compliance with that, and in compliance with the provisions of the Minnesota Constitution? So now we're going to get into the details. We kind of talked about some of the big issues last time. But in our financial audit division, we do dig very deep into the details. We go into the agency files. We interview people in great detail about how they're managing the money. And we're very committed to doing that work each year. And Ms. Ferkel will talk to you about how we're scheduling that and some of the issues that we are surfacing in that work. So, again, thank you for making time for us to be here.
Okay. And just in general, as we go through this procedure, I don't know how much of our general stuff you hear about us. But if you have any suggestions to us as we're doing appropriating about how an appropriation could better be structured, to we're very amenable. We may not do it, you tell us to, but we're very amenable to hearing it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, because one of the things that we struggle with sometimes is the clarity of the law. Mm-hmm. So one of the things you'll hear from us over and over again, if as you are appropriating money and you are putting, as we often say, strings attached, in other words, you're putting language in the appropriation law or even in the statute that sets the conditions for the expenditure of this money, the more clear you can be without leaving it up to an interpretation of intent, the more you will support our work, which is to go in and determine whether or not people have expended the money in compliance with the terms of the law. And we don't want to make up those conditions. We want to be able to read the law and say it's clear, and then look at the fact of how the money was spent and make a judgment as to whether or not there was compliance. So thank you for the invitation, and we will undoubtedly be following the work of this committee. And as we look at those bills, if we are uncertain about what the language means and we are ultimately going to have to do audit work against that language, we may come and visit and ask for some clarification. So, again, thank you.
Well, what I was interested in particularly was pre-clarification. Has anyone ever asked you that before?
Every once in a while, Madam Chair, but not maybe often enough. And, frankly, okay. I realize that, you know, as staff to the legislature, we operate somewhat differently. We're usually away from this building doing our work in the agencies, and I know a lot of the work that you do in putting bills together has to be done by the staff you have on that side of the table. But we can develop that relationship. I know the staff that works for this committee. I can be in touch with them. And so, yes, I think if there are issues that come up that we see, we can try to point those out and see if we can get clarification. Now, I know, having worked on the other side of the table in the early years of my career, sometimes you can not always be crystal clear in the law for a variety of reasons. Sometimes that inhibits the passage. But so I understand how that sometimes might work. Or there's a limit to how clear you can be with the English language. But if we have suggestions, we will certainly bring them to you or to the staff.
Okay, thank you. The quorum being present, Representative Lilly, I'm sure that you've carefully read the minutes, and Representative Lilly moves adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Great. Okay, Ms. Ferkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor, responsible for the Financial Audit Division, and that's where a lot of the detailed audit work related to legacy gets done. When we do our audits, we start with a real broad analysis of how the money is spent. And we do that by getting information from the state's accounting system. So we have all the detailed information, and we analyze that a variety of different ways. We go out into the agencies. We talk with agency staff about the policies and procedures that they're following and how they're conducting this work, what kind of files they keep. And then we pull a sample of transactions and drill down into those transactions, pull the files to see the grant agreements, to see the reimbursement requests or the support for the payments. And that's really the basis for our conclusions. So first I want to go back to, we've got 2 years of audits that I want to cover today, so I first want to go back to our 2011 financial audits. During 2011, we looked at the use of money from three of the funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, and the Parks and Trails Fund. And looking at those funds led us to primarily three departments, the Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we also did follow the money trail down to some of the grantees who received legacy money through those three departments. And we went to 10 different grantees and looked at how they were using the money and at their accounting systems, their internal controls, and their support for their expenditures too. So in deciding our scope, this slide shows you, and first maybe I should back up. You do have slides, if you have them, from our last meeting from a couple of weeks ago. I'm on about slide 14 or 15 right now. But there also are additional slide handouts if you'd like them up front here. So when we looked at the expenditures that occurred between July of 2009 and January of 2000.
That's on page 3 of the slide.
Thank you. So we looked at the expenditures from July 2009 through January 2011, and we looked at what agencies were spending that money. And from this slide, you can see that about 88% of the expenditures were in the three agencies that we focused on, and about 12% were in a number of other agencies, including the U of M and the legislature also. So we felt that by looking at those three agencies, we were getting a pretty broad view of the expenditures. And we also looked at then how the departments were spending the money. What were they using it for? And we found that DNR was primarily using it to buy land and make grants. PCA was primarily using it internally for payroll costs and other kinds of departmental expenses. And Bowser was primarily making grants but also had some land purchases. So there were a variety of ways that the departments were using the money. Our conclusions on that audit were that their internal controls were generally adequate, and that means that they were doing a pretty good job, but we did have a few findings. There were six findings in that report, and I'd like to just highlight a few of them. The first finding examined how the different agencies were allocating costs to the programs, and we found some inconsistencies and some allocations that really weren't representing appropriate use of the money. Payroll costs, for example, we found, just as one example, an employee that had been assigned on a legacy funded project for about 2 weeks right before he retired. And then all of the severance payment was paid out of that account, even though the person had worked for the department for a variety of years. And the exceptions we found we didn't think were being done maliciously, but that they were following the way that the state generally would have done that. But when we looked at it from a legacy perspective, we said that that really did not represent an appropriate use of legacy money. We also found some inconsistencies between the way payroll costs were allocated, set up initially, you know, 40% out of this fund and 60% out of that fund. And then when we examined how the employee actually worked or charged their time on their timesheets, it didn't represent that same kind of allocation. So what we're recommending is that the departments go back and look at how they are charging payroll costs, that they have a way to validate that the allocations that they set up are appropriate, and that they have a way to make sure that any other kinds of charges related to payroll get allocated appropriately to the right funds. Also, cost allocations, you know, through the course of time, the requirement in the statute related to indirect costs or administrative costs has changed. We talked about that when we got together the last time. So we were kind of working in a little bit of a moving environment there, but now with the language that the costs need to be directly related to and necessary for, that's going to be our standard working moving forward of what we're examining. But some of the cost allocations that we did see didn't really support that the indirect costs that were being paid with funds were really had a relationship to the appropriation. For example, one of the ones that we explain in the report is that the Pollution Control Agency would determine an indirect cost rate, and I think it was 18% around there, and they would take that or charge that to the funds right in the first year of the appropriation. Well, one of the appropriations that they got is mainly for grant expenditures, and that 18% didn't really represent, or the department really wasn't able to show us how the 18% really represented the cost of the administration of a grant program. So we are, again, recommending as a part of that that the agencies make sure that they are able to draw a good connection between the costs that are charged. And we also recommended that MMB, Management and Budget, try to provide some policies for state agencies in terms of what can be allowed and what cannot be allowed, and that's something that I'll talk about in a little bit. Another area that we talked about was that some agencies were making advances to grantees. That's allowable under policy, but not always a recommended way. It's better at times to have the grantee submit for reimbursement for costs they have incurred. The exceptions that we had in the report, though, were where the grant agreement actually said that the grant was going to be on a reimbursement basis, and yet the funds were advanced to the grantee regardless of that grant agreement requirement. And another area was oversight of grantees. We found some noncompliance where reimbursements were made for costs that didn't comply with the grant agreement in some instances, or where the agency didn't have sufficient documentation to be able to really look and assess at whether or not those costs complied with the grant agreement or were allowable under the terms of the grant. And we also had a couple of issues related to match requirements at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Their grant agreements typically did not include specific language about what the match requirement was. There was a match requirement. It was not in the grant agreements. And so we recommended to them that they put that as a term of the grant. And at the Pollution Control Agency, there were a couple of instances. One was where there was a statutory deadline that there be that the match be confirmed by a certain date, and we didn't see evidence that Pollution Control had done that. Although we were able to determine that the match requirement had been met, we just didn't see that the department had taken that responsibility to ensure that. And also that some of the expenses of the grantee that were being shown as being match for the grant really weren't the kinds of costs that met the grant requirements. So we didn't think there was a good fit, and we felt that the agency should be more provide more review to make sure that the costs that are pledged as matching on the grant really have a good relationship to the purpose of the grant. So in 2012, we moved on to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And we took a different approach to this fund. When we looked in 2011 at the three funds and those three agencies, we were really narrowing our examination to how those three agencies spent the legacy dollars. With the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, we decided to do separate audits of a variety of agencies and not limit ourselves to just how they oversaw or administered Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, but to look more broadly at their programs. So, for example, one of the agencies that we went to was the Minnesota State Arts Board. We examined not only how they used arts and cultural heritage money in their grant administration, but we also looked at their general fund grants. And so in each of these agencies, to some degree or another, we expanded our examination to starting with arts and cultural and then expanded it out to other aspects of their operations. So we thought this gave us a broader view of how they're conducting their financial management within the agencies and making sure that their controls overall in their administration of state funds, including arts and cultural heritage, was appropriate. We also looked at various grantees, and that was really depending on how well we thought the state agency was providing oversight. And there was one agency that we didn't go in down to the grantee level for any of the dollars, and that was the department or the Historical Society. They were conducting such a thorough review of all their grantees, requiring documentation for every cost that was incurred, that we were able to see just through the Historical Society's files that there was adequate support and adequate oversight by the Historical Society, and we didn't think it was a good use of our time to go down to the grantee level. I will say, though, that their review was very thorough. It may not be the model. It takes a lot of time for them to do that. That's a decision that they've made, that they want to do that degree of oversight. It's not the expectation in other state agencies that oversight is that intensive, but we were quite impressed with Historical Society's approach to their grant oversight. Other grantees that we did look at were the public library systems, public radio, children's museum, science museum, regional arts councils, the Guthrie, the Walker. It provided a nice opportunity for our auditors to get out of the Capitol complex a little bit and see some things that they don't often get a chance to see.
Does that mean in order to judge it, you had to go to a Guthrie play?
Madam Chair, we did not, as a part of the audit, attend the Guthrie play. But we did get to a behind-the-scenes tour, which was really quite interesting.
Representative, did you have a question? I do, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. A question under the on your table 2, your contents of the Purpich Center for the Arts and Education, the Zoological Board. Under grants, it's zero. So am I, in the fiscal years of 2010 to 2012, they received zero grants. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, member, you're referring to Table 2 in the letter that summarizes the results of the legacy work that we did this year on page 3 of that letter. Table 2 shows that Purpich Center did not make any grants. The purpose of their appropriation was to conduct certain studies within their own organizations. I think that they were doing a survey or questionnaire of schools to see to what degree or how arts and cultural heritage was integrated. I think that's what they were doing as a way to gather information in order to better serve schools. I'm sorry, I'm a little vague on it, but they weren't making grants to other entities.
Sure, thank you. Then under the payroll, the $500,000 for the Purpich Center of the Arts and then Zoological Board of $410,000, is that payroll for their organizations then, and is that paid for out of the legacy funds?
Madam Chair, yes, that's right. That's payroll of their own employees that they paid for with legacy funds in order to accomplish the purposes of the grant. I mean, the purpose of the appropriation. Okay. So again, in looking at how Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund money was spent from July 2009 through June 2012, we can again see that the six organizations where we did testing constituted 97% of the expenditures. So we got a good broad look at the use of that money by looking at the Minnesota State Arts Board, the Historical Society, the Department of Administration, the Department of Education, the Humanities Center, and the Purpich Center for Arts Education. And in looking at how they use that money, and this is getting back in the letter is more of the dollar amounts that were spent, but this slide shows just a percentage of how those organizations spent their money. And you can see that primarily, other than for Purpich Center of the Arts, the money was granted out to other organizations. So our focus in 2012 was very much on grant administration by these entities, and much less so on their administrative costs, because they didn't use a significant amount of their money on administrative costs. And most of these agencies were charging direct payroll, people that were directly working on the grants rather than allocations of indirect costs like we had seen with the other funds. Also, I should note, Historical Society is 100% and Humanities Centers is 100%. This slide is based on how transactions look in the state's accounting system, and so it looks like grants out to those organizations, but I believe that Historical Society, Humanities Center may have spent some money, if we were looking at their accounting system, may have spent some money on internal operations. But we did see that the majority of that money was still used for grants, even at that level. So in looking at our conclusions, we issued six different reports, one for each agency. The purpose of the letter that I referred to is to kind of bring the results of that together. The conclusions were pretty much, for most of the entities, generally adequate, but they had a few weaknesses. There were no findings in the Purpich Center report related to legacy, their use of that money. We didn't have any exceptions or weaknesses. And one organization, Education, we felt was not adequately overseeing their use of legacy funds. So I'd like to get into that now. There are a couple of findings that I would characterize as being significant findings. One of them was at the Department of Education. Their grants were primarily to the regional library systems, and they already had a process in place with other money that they distribute to the regional library systems, and they followed their same practices. But we took exception to what they were doing with the legacy funds. For one thing, they were not, they did not have grant agreements that explained the terms and conditions, the payment requirements, related to how the library systems were going to use the legacy money. It was distributed to them without grant agreements, and we felt that that created a weakness. Grant agreements are legal documents that spell out the terms, requirements, restrictions, expectations, and they are generally used for grants across the state. It is a part of state policy that grant agreements be used when grants are made. So that was one of the areas that we felt was a weakness by the Department of Education. And also, Education had not set out specific requirements, which certainly could have been part of a grant agreement, but because they didn't have them, didn't have a grant agreement, they weren't spelled out, but they didn't do it in other ways either. So we saw inconsistencies between how the library systems oversaw that money or understood any limitations or restrictions. For example, some of the library systems subsequently granted that money to other entities, and there were inconsistencies about whether or not grant agreements existed at that level or not, and Education hadn't established that grant agreements would be an expectation or requirement. They also had variances in how they documented or entered into contracts to execute the terms of the grant. And there was a varying degree of documentation, more dependent on what the organization's normal documentation practices would be. But we felt that with legacy money, there's a higher expectation that you can document how the money was, how the legacy money was used, that you have invoices, that you have receipts for this money. And so when we went out and tested, we saw varying degrees of documentation and some deficiencies in that area, too. So we felt that that really is the Department of Education's responsibility to set up that structure, to lay out those expectations, to have grant agreements that spell those terms out. And we felt without that in place, that was a significant weakness on their part. Another entity where we had a more specific issue that we felt was a significant weakness was the Humanities Center. They had one grantee who received a little over $200,000, so not a lot of money, but it's still $200,000. So that grantee received the money and provided some reporting, but had never submitted a final report and was unable to provide us with documentation to support how that money was spent. The Humanities Center said that they had relied on interim reporting and on progress reports, but from an audit standpoint, auditors like to see actual documentation to support where the money went and how it was used, and we were never able to satisfy ourselves about that. So our recommendation was that Humanities Center continue to work with the grantee. There actually was a retirement involved of the person who was working on this, but there are some an organization that's taking responsibility, and that Humanities Centers continue to work with them to determine whether or not any money needs to be repaid to the state related to that grant. So throughout these six audits, too, we did see some common findings. One of the things, especially for the state agencies, education, administration, not purpose because they didn't have grants, but yes, ma'am.
Just again looking at your letter, it says in its response to our finding, the census management said it resolved the concern October 31st, 2012.
Did they?
Madam Chair, we haven't followed up with them. Perhaps they're here today. Oh, I don't know, and you may be able to ask them.
Although, Madam Chair, I might just add that when we go back to an organization, we do follow up on previous findings. It's always one of the objectives that we have for any audit is to follow up on prior recommendations. Unfortunately, given our resources and the scope of work we do, we don't always get back very frequently to some organizations. But there is, I might add, a follow-up process that the executive branch uses for all of our financial audit recommendations. And so over the years, I think we've developed a fairly good system, which involves us sometimes, but also the Department of Management and Budget, to follow up and try to track implementation of our recommendations.
So a common finding that we found with state agencies, and that's the Arts Board, the Department of Administration, and the Department of Education, was that there was difficulty complying with some of the state's grants management policies. These policies have been established over the last 3-4 years, with some revisions happening during that time period also. And they're designed to make sure that state agencies are doing a good job of administering, overseeing, monitoring how state grant money is used. They're not specific to the legacy funds, but they do also apply to grants made with legacy money. There are two elements that we look at pretty specifically when we're doing our review that really provide agencies with their best ability to assess whether or not compliance with the grant agreement is occurring and whether or not the costs that are being paid for are appropriate to the grant, to the appropriation. And those are the financial reconciliations and the site visits that are required by state grant policies. At a minimum, those financial reconciliations, which means that for one reimbursement request, which might be for a month or it might be for a quarter, for one reimbursement request, the grantee is required to submit all the documentation to support the reimbursements that they're requesting. So they have to submit payroll registers, and they have to submit invoices and contracts and that kind of stuff. So generally, it's required at least once during a grant period. If a grant is over $50,000, it has to be once a year. This is a really, for an agency that does a lot of grants, this is a pretty high expectation, even though it's just one reimbursement a year or one reimbursement a grant. That sounds pretty minimal. But when you're an organization like the State Arts Board, you give a lot of grants that exceed $50,000, and keeping up with this kind of monitoring can be difficult. The other thing is the site visits, and those are where you go out to the grantee. Ideally, you go out to the grantee.
Do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, to that point that you just made, I'll just say specifically the Minnesota State Arts Board. I mean, and you look at the table, and they certainly are table two, the largest amount of grants. Do you ever look at, this is a whole new direction. Did they staff up? And if they didn't, that's a huge work imposition. Do you make a judgment like that or a recommendation like that when you observe that they haven't adequately monitored?
Madam Chair and member, that's a management decision that they need to consider whether or not they have sufficient resources. What we recommend is they comply with the policy, that they do what they need to do to comply with the policy. So I know there are people here from the Arts Board, and perhaps they can speak to that about how they have designed an approach to comply with the policy. There is the ability also to propose a different plan than what the policy lays out, and the Arts Board may have considered then that maybe there's a different way that they can provide sufficient oversight of their broad grant authorities, but in a different way than what the policy requires, and then that requires approval by the Department of Administration. But we thought it was interesting that even the Department of Administration that sets out the policy was not able to comply with the policy either. When we had our exit conference with the Department of Administration, we said, you know, maybe the policy, even though it sounds like it's a good approach, maybe it's too strict, maybe it's too much to expect. Wouldn't it maybe be better to set a policy that agencies are able to comply with that looks at this in a different way? The department representatives respond. They said, no, we think the policy is where it should be. We think you're going to see better compliance in the future as agencies do develop ways and have sufficient staffing in order to meet those expectations. And you know, I guess when you stand back and look at it, looking at support for one reimbursement request through the life of a grant or one reimbursement request a year if the grant's over $50,000, that doesn't sound like too much oversight. It's certainly not at the level where the Historical Society is, which provides very good, strong oversight, but I think it would be really burdensome for a state agency to review the detailed support for every single cost that's incurred by the grantee. And so the state has set the bar at that level.
Madam Chair, if I could just expand just very briefly to the point, because it is very central to some of the discussion undoubtedly you're going to have throughout this year as you allocate money to state agencies and nonprofits, and that is how do they staff up, as you suggested, to fulfill their responsibilities? And those responsibilities are going to vary, as we noted, depending on whether or not they're being asked to directly deliver the service or the legacy objective or whatever is being called for, or they're going to be asked to grant money out. And so there are a variety of requirements. We acknowledge everywhere we go, and certainly in this report, we acknowledged very explicitly that dedicated money, whether it's statutorily dedicated or constitutionally dedicated, imposes additional requirements, more paperwork, more justification, more documentation. And so we acknowledge that, and we acknowledge that this comes with a cost. And one of the policy questions I think you are going to always have, and that is how to cover that cost. And we talked about this some last time, because as this new venture under the Legacy Amendment has come to us, many agencies have lost general fund funding. And so what they might have been able to use to cover some of those costs, in some cases, is gone. And yet, again, as we talked last time, we don't want legacy money just to be soaked up to fill the hole that was created by the budget cuts. We want to accomplish new things. That's what the Legacy Amendment was all about. So I think the most we can do is to recognize that this is difficult, it is complicated. I would commend to you again the discussion that we had in this evaluation report under the administrative costs. One of the things we certainly tried to do in this report is to present to you what we heard from agencies about the challenges they face. We quote some of the commissioners. We quote some of the interviews we had with them. And not to ignore it at all. It is an added burden. The work is going to need to get done somehow, some way. I don't think we can just walk away from the need for accountability, documentation, if we're going to achieve accountability. So it is going to be, as we said in this report, an ongoing issue.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nobles, you're kind of going right into what I was going to ask, and that is to echo your comments that this is an ongoing process. It hopefully we make improvements as we go along. And when we established over the last few years the accountability and transparency practices, the question was always, are we asking for too much? Is this too burdensome? In your estimation, are the requests for reporting realistic, the ones that have been proposed?
Madam Chair and members, I think they are. I think partly because of your good efforts and trying to be responsive and flexible, that we have arrived at this standard of needed and reasonable. It does still require documentation and justification for their determination that those costs were in fact needed and reasonable. And so we will ask for that. Again, I don't know how we get away from some level of expectation and requirement. And I don't want this to be misinterpreted at all, but we just recently completed an investigation of a grant, not a legacy-related grant. But I think it's illustrative of what can occur in state government if we simply give the money and walk away and don't do our due diligence to follow up and determine in a reasonable way how the money is being spent. And so in this case, the Department of Health had been granting money over several years to a private nonprofit organization, doing some level of due diligence, actually doing some amount of requiring documentation and reconciliation, never doing, frankly, an adequate site visit. But we determined through our investigation that the grant money was being used virtually completely for private expenditures and to achieve no public purpose whatsoever. And so that report and our evidence in that investigation has been turned over, in this case because some of the money was federal money, to the U.S. attorney and to the FBI, and there will be consequences to that individual. But, you know, it happens rarely, and certainly, again, I don't suggest that anybody in this room receiving legacy money would do anything like that. But what it tells us is when state money is out there, there does need to be accountability, and it does need to be kind of built into the ongoing day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month relationships that are built between agencies and the nonprofit grant-receiving organizations.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knowles, did you receive many calls from, you know, entities who were filling out these reports asking with questions or asking for assistance?
Well, Madam Chair and members, we certainly did discuss with them, but we try, and I think we do not, try to interpose ourselves into setting the requirements. In fact, what we emphasize over and over again is that that needs to be done by the executive branch. First, it will be done by you in the law, but those details need to really be filled in by the executive branch through the Office of Grants Management and the individual agencies. That's frankly why we had the finding that we did about the Department of Education, because they didn't do that. They needed to specify in the grant agreement what were the requirements and expectations. We don't want the grant receiving organization to be coming to us as the auditor. That's not our job. Now, we do try to work with the agencies to try to set those expectations up, to create that those grant agreements up front. And then when we do go out and deal with some of the nonprofits, we do try to do a certain amount of educating, I guess you could call it, about what the expectations are going to be when people receive state money. It's an opportunity for me to mention that in about 2 weeks you're going to receive another report from us, from our Program Evaluation Division, on conservation easements. And as you probably know, conservation easements are increasingly being funded through legacy money. And two of the organizations that we will highlight in that report are nonprofit organizations that receive a significant amount of money to purchase conservation easements. And again, we heard from them, again, the sort of burden it might be for them to deal with all the paperwork and accountability and oversight that comes with receiving public money from the state of Minnesota. And their world probably would be, you know, a lot simpler and easier if we just give them the money. And these particular organizations, frankly, I think are very upstanding, very professionally run organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Land Trust, and there are some others. And we have a high regard for their professionalism. But it's a business relationship, and it needs to be done appropriately and properly. There needs to be paperwork. You will hear from them if you invite them. You can also read their response to our audit report. Their response will be in the report. And there will be a bit of tension about what we think the state has to expect from them in terms of documentation and approval and how they want to operate as a private organization. It's going to be one of those ongoing tensions that exist. Our role as the Legislative Auditor's Office, as the auditor responsible for ensuring integrity, accountability, and appropriate use of public money, is to emphasize what is required on the public side of this. They can advocate for themselves the way they want to do business with the state. It's our job to tell them, from our perspective, what is required in terms of accountability, because ultimately you, the people we work for, have to go back and be accountable to your constituents for how that public money was used. And the more times we can prevent that money from being misused, the happier you're going to be, because the happier your constituents are going to be.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question, Mr. Knowles, regarding your supplement and substitute section of the audit. You recommend the legislature should do, let's see, excuse me, let's see, recommend the legislature establish a process for us to use and obtain program and project level data on the sources of funding. So I have two questions. When you suggest that, do you have an actual recommendation that we do those two things that you suggest? And then I'll let you answer that, and if I could have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, we recommended that the fiscal note process, although that too was the subject of one of our evaluations and certainly has its limitations, but what we were suggesting is that when you're in session, and as we all know, it's very busy, lots going on, and you need information to make decisions, and so you've established the fiscal note process. And what we were looking for is something that could be plugged into a very busy legislative session where you could get some information from, let's say, DNR. DNR comes to you and says they would like some legacy money to do a particular kind of activity. And what we were suggesting is that you get from them, and with the assistance of your staff, some background information from them. Historically, how have they funded that? Has it been through bond money, general fund money, game and fish money? How have they funded that activity so that you can have some sense of, are we building on top of what has historically been there? Or, again, are we filling a hole with legacy money because money from those traditional sources has been cut? And again, we don't think there's an absolute mathematical calculus that will solve this problem, because frankly, sometimes they may say to you, well, over the last 2 years, yeah, we did that project with bond money, but that was only a two-year appropriation, and it really wasn't long enough to establish as a traditional source. And so we don't think we're really substituting for bond money. We just think we were able to get bond money for those 2 years, and it won't be there in the future. And we can't count on that, but we do want to keep this program going. That might be one scenario, but you might hear in another scenario that, you know, for the last 20 years, we funded that money, that program, with game and fish money. And so you will see in that information that you get that there is a much more historical, traditional funding of that program from a different source. And I think you would have a lot more reason to say, well, if we use that money in the past for 20 years, and now you're going to use that money for something else, but we're going to keep the project going with legacy money, aren't we at risk of substituting rather than supplementing? So again, we were just calling for a process for there to be more information so that you can make an informed decision. There was some resistance to that recommendation because, again, it adds work to people during a very busy time of the legislative process, but we think it would serve you well to have that information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that seems like a very common sense and logical approach and a great recommendation, and frankly, I'm surprised that process wasn't done in the beginning, although this is still fairly new when you think of all the programs of the state of Minnesota, but a very logical common sense approach, and I hope that we'll follow your advice, Mr. Nobles. And then my second part of the question is in your recommendation. You recommend that the recipients of legacy money take the supplement, not substitute provision seriously. Now, how do we as a committee oversee in the those who are recipients, how do we ensure that they take it seriously?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think by your emphasis on that point, and frankly also you have put that in the law, as I recall from the last bill. It's in the Constitution, obviously. And so some might have said, well, you really didn't have to put it in the law. But I think partly to carry it forward and just to make it clear to everybody that, and actually there was a bit of a legal question involved there, and that is, was the supplement, not substitute, language only applicable to the state, to you as the legislature, to state agencies, or was it also applicable to organizations, particularly nonprofit, private organizations, once they receive that And the determination, there was some analysis of this by Mark Shepard, that yes, indeed, that the constitutional provision is attached to the money, not to organizations. So anybody that receives the legacy money has to be attentive to this constitutional requirement. How do you enforce it? Well, it will be challenging because you will need to get deep into the financial structure of organizations, and that isn't always easy for you to do here in these hearings. We will certainly try to help you out as we go into these organizations and do some analysis of their historical financial structures and whether or not we see them using legacy money to simply substitute for other money. But again, in our report, we recognize that this will not always be easy, even for us, because there isn't always this bright line about what was the traditional source of funding for that particular activity. But to the degree we can, we will help you try to, if not enforce, at least inform you about what's occurring.
Okay. Anything else? Okay.
All right.
Final.
So another area that there are a couple of things I wanted to talk about that aren't specifically within the audits. One of them has to do with the administrative costs. Again, remember, for these particular audits, we really were very grant-focused. Administrative costs were not really a big part of it. But in response to our previous report and our findings related to DNR and PCA about their allocation of administrative costs to the three outdoor heritage, clean water, and parks and trails, the Department of Management and Budget did spend some time and come out with some guidelines about what would be allowable and what would not be allowable. There was the document is quite lengthy. I think it's 10 or 14 pages long and provides a lot of discussion about what administrative costs are, what indirect costs are, what allocations are, what direct and necessary means, what directly related to means. And in the end, we think it didn't really go far enough, even though it was quite a lengthy document, because it is just set out as a policy. It's not, I mean, as a guidance to agencies. There's nothing in it that requires any kind of, there's no requirements or rules or policy around it. So we're still going to be going out to agencies and trying to understand how they're identifying costs as being directly related to and necessary for. And I really kind of got the feel reading through it that you could find a way to connect almost any cost to legacy funds if you tried hard enough, and that the requirement really was that they document their thought process so that when the auditors came in, they'd have something to show us. So we're going to use that guidance as kind of a soft audit criteria. But really go back to the appropriation and use our harder criteria, which is that it has to be directly related to and necessary for the purposes of the grant. And so we'll see in upcoming audits how that guidance either does better guide agencies and what's allowable, what's not allowable, or whether or not it just provides them with a way to allocate administrative costs that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise allocated. They do lay out in the policy federal allowable costs policies as maybe a way to judge whether or not something's allowable or not. But, you know, when you get a federal grant, those policies are not discretionary. They're not just guidance. They are connected to the terms of the grant agreement, and you do have to comply with them. And every year we audit the state's major federal programs to make sure that the state is complying with the allowable cost principles that the state sets up. I mean, that the federal government sets up. And I guess from an audit standpoint, as an auditor, I'd rather see something that's got a little more bite to it than just a guidance out there for interpretation by varieties of people. Another aspect of it, too, is it applicable to grantees or not? It says in the guidance that grantees also should follow this or follow these principles, but what makes them do that? If it's not in a grant agreement, I don't know how you enforce that at the grantee level unless it's incorporated in as a term of the grant, and there's nothing in the policy, in the guidance that says that that would be the case. So I think it was a good effort, but I would have liked to have seen it go a little farther in setting out requirements for state agencies.
Well, I might have mentioned this before, but some experience that actually goes back even before I was a legislator was being a grant recipient and working at the University of Minnesota. One of the things we noticed was that the federal university had a very, very high billing for federal agents. Again, this is a very long time ago. I don't know if it's changed. But a very high billing to federal agencies for indirect costs. And in fact, when I switched to a private agency at one point, the private granting group said, we don't pay that much. And the university just accepted what they paid. So, you know, I don't know what the federal process really is. It certainly had no relationship to the cost of the grants. And I apologize if I've said this before to this group, because I know I've said it to a bunch of people. But I had a federal grant working in biological sciences where they had to give me water and clean up and electricity and all sorts of stuff. And my husband had a federal grant in the Department of Mathematics where all he needed was a blackboard. I don't even think they needed to give him that. And I think the indirect costs were the same, which...
And Madam Chair, I might just point out that as we have gone over to the university and specifically on general obligation bond appropriations to the university, we've been critical, frankly, of their use of that method to simply charge a large percentage overhead, whether the costs were directly related to the specific project or not. But that is the way the university operates. And frankly, it's the way some agencies would prefer to operate, and that is to simply charge a certain percentage across the board for all of their grants and fund a certain amount of indirect costs that they do have, and they have to pay for some way. Yeah. So we recognize that there is a bind there. But again, our purpose, and I think yours, is to make sure that there's integrity for these individual funds. I mean, and on bond funds, as Representative Hausman certainly knows, I mean, we can run afoul of the constitutional limitations on how general obligation bonds can be used, as we can run afoul on how legacy money can be used because of the constitutional requirement. So, again, on a lot of these, there's complexities, there's tension, and I think Ms. Ferkel has a wrap-up of just a few more issues. Okay.
But just, well, before we leave this, just legitimately, let's look at something. A commissioner or something needs to spend, say, an hour a week on dealing with legacy issues on the average. You know, maybe they're taking, maybe not every week, but maybe it's 3 hours some week and so forth. Is that, and I guess I know the commissioner's salary is a lot higher than my salary, his hourly salary, but the question is that a legitimate indirect cost of a grant?
Well, Madam Chair, it could be a direct cost. I mean, if the commissioner justify that he or she was working on that specific program and his or her work was absolutely directly related to and necessary fulfilling the purposes of that appropriation, it could be a direct cost. But I do think that commissioners and others need to be careful, not to necessarily load up a lot of costs on dedicated funds without real clear documentation. And I don't think it's enough just to say, well, you know, I spend roughly 10-20% of my time working on legacy issues, so over the next year I'll charge legacy funds that percent. I do think if you're going to do it, particularly if you're an administrator and you have general responsibilities and a large percentage of your time is not dedicated to that legacy project, I think you need to be very careful. And frankly, we've discussed this with a lot of agency officials and a lot of nonprofits, and they vary. A lot of times it depends on what their financial situation is. I talked to one nonprofit that said, yeah, I mean, we got to pay our executive director. It's got to come from somewhere, and we've got to charge the legacy funds for some of that salary. I've talked to other nonprofits who said, we will never charge any part of the executive secretary's or executive director's salary to legacy money because we don't want to raise any concern that we are simply supporting our administrative staff with legacy money. So there is difference, but ultimately, if you charge, you need to justify and document.
And it's perfect justification that it took you 3 hours to understand something just because you're kind of dumb. Is that all right?
Do I really have to answer that?
No. Just thrown out as a rhetorical question.
Madam Chair, I also have a...
And that you was not directed to you. That you is a general you to the world. Yes.
Okay, Ms. Madam Merkel. Chair, I also have a few other areas, things that we ran across as part of the audit that were not audit weaknesses, but they were issues that we discussed that we thought, and early on you said things that perhaps would be legislative changes to some of the appropriations, and maybe some of this touches on that. The first one is if a state agency advances money out to a grantee, for example, the Department of Education advanced money out to the library systems, and then those organizations put that money in a bank or maybe into an investment fund, and that money earns interest or has investment earnings, is that interest in investment earnings a part of the grant and also restricted in the way that the grant or the appropriation is restricted, or is that earnings available for them to use for their general operations or in any way that they want? Again, we didn't run across this. This was something we discussed, and I think with today's low interest rates and low investment earnings at times, you know, it's less likely to occur, but we thought this was something that we might encounter in an audit, and we really did not see a policy or a rule or a limitation to it. So it would be a difficult thing, I think, for us to judge whether or not that money was part of the grant or part of the organization's operational costs. We also, part of the appropriations, provided what's called institutional support grants to some arts organizations. As we went out and did our audit work on that, we found that those organizations were, you know, institutional support is like operational costs, you know, they put that money in with their general operations. And when we said, well, how did you use the state's legacy money for institutional costs, they were unable to identify for a specific cost that they incurred. It was in their accounting system. We felt they had good controls. Their accounting system accounted for costs overall, but we couldn't say how did they specifically use that money. So, you know, the institutional support grants seem to cross over into administrative or operational support kinds of costs for these organizations. It's places like the Guthrie and the Walker Arts Center. And so there's no specific outcome or specific program or grant purpose that we're able to say, was it achieved? How did they use the money? And so that created some difficulty for us. We did, as I said, look to make sure that they had a good accounting of the money, of, you know, that their accounting system and their controls generally would provide good oversight of the use of the money, but we really weren't able to test specifically how that money was used. We also saw that the state's grants management policies, while they clearly apply to state agencies, it was less clear to us and to other entities how they applied to a place like the Historical Society or the Humanities Center, which are not state agencies. How do they apply to grantees? Are the same rules in place for them as they would be for a state agency? And so that created some inconsistencies for us as we were doing our testing. As I said before, the Historical Society was doing a great job of monitoring how grantees were using the money, but they didn't have to follow the state's grants management policies. They chose to make those decisions themselves. And so we think that it creates, you know, the Humanities Center, it created some difficulty for them, too, to know what rules they were supposed to operate under. And it creates difficulty for us also when we go into audit to know what rules to apply to them. So I think that some clarification about the applicability of the state's grants management policies in the legacy grants would be helpful for the organizations and for us. And then the last bullet that I have there is payments that are bypassing state policies and bargaining agreements, and that sounds kind of ominous, I know. But what was happening here was that the appropriation was to the Humanities Center, and they were making payments in accordance with the appropriation that said that, that the Humanity Center should collaborate with the Councils of Color. Now, the Councils of Color are state agencies. So what we saw was that the money went outside of state government to the Humanity Center, which is a, not a state agency, went to them, and they were making payments on behalf of and reimbursements to employees of the Councils of Color, rather than that, like a travel reimbursement. If you're a state employee, you're limited by the state's bargaining agreements to how much you can be reimbursed for lunch or how much you can be reimbursed for travel. But because those payments were going directly from the Humanity Center to the employee rather than through the state system to the employee, they were not necessarily restricted to that. Now, we expanded our testing because we thought that this created additional risk that perhaps the employee got reimbursed both by the state agency and through the Humanity Center. Or maybe they got reimbursed in amounts or for things that they weren't allowed to get reimbursed for or in amounts that weren't allowable. We didn't find any exceptions, but we thought that this created kind of an odd payment stream that provided an opportunity that could be exploited. So, you know, it just seems odd to take the money out of the control of state government and then use it to make payments back into state government and to state employees. So just our observation there. So I do, all our reports are available online. Let us know if you'd like a hard copy. We can get those to you. I do want to talk about our audit efforts coming up in 2013. We are going to focus on DNR. We're going to look across DNR, across a variety of dedicated funding, including their use of outdoor heritage and parks and trails. And we're going to really look at how they do allocate costs among all the variety of funding sources that they have, whether they're state programs, federal programs, game and fish fund programs, legacy fund programs, and make sure that those allocations are really complying with good accounting practices and with the appropriation laws. So we're going to focus on that. Then the following year, in 2014, we expect that we will go to pollution control and the Board of Water and Soil Resources and look at some of the Clean Water Fund expenditures there and maybe also look back at some of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund expenditures too. Any Representative Murphy?
When you were doing your audits of the agencies that had purchased land, did the discussions or did you get information that said that the value of the lands had now shifted because they were purchased with legacy funding, and so the use for the lands was different, and that changed the value of the lands that the owners might have to pay taxes on?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, this is an issue we are going to discuss fairly extensively in our conservation easement report, although you ask about the purchase. I think the same issues apply, and we did examine two aspects of what I think you're talking about. One is the initial appraisal of the property that is going to be purchased, and or if it's going to be an easement is going to be acquired. And it is, I think we all understand, a complex calculation. It can be somewhat subjective, but you know, there are professionals that do it, and it can be done well. And so we will be discussing that. And then the other piece that I think you're asking about is what is the impact on the value, not only, frankly, of the parcels that have been either purchased or on which conservation easements have been acquired. What is the now current value? If it's been purchased by the state, what has that done to the surrounding land? And this gets into the PILT payment issue, which we did cover fairly extensively in an earlier report. But frankly, for easements as well, there is an issue, not a pill, because it isn't a purchase of the land. There is a very real issue about how land is appraised by the tax assessors, is assessed by the tax assessors. And not only the land on which the conservation easement has been acquired, but potentially surrounding land. We will be addressing that issue, so I think we can come back to you in a couple of weeks and discuss it in more detail then, if we can defer that.
Madam Murphy. Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, I think you got to my what I was thinking of when I was asking the question, but then we're talking about DNR going forward. And so I would like you to keep that in mind, too, depending on what you tell us in a couple weeks on the land easements. But we have to think about if it does change value, then the taxpayers are paying for the acquisition of these lands or the easements with the legacy, with their legacy money, with the tax 3/8 money, and then again they're going to have to pay when they're not given reimbursement in the areas, you know, property taxes may have to rise because some of this land is now off the state rolls.
Madam Chair and
Representative
Murphy.
So that's double taxation.
And it is an issue that I think we all ought to be considering as we are doing these good things by purchasing land or using conservation easements, that there may be a ripple effect, an added secondary burden on people in the local vicinity that for purchase, of course, we try to mitigate through PILT payment. And there is a controversy about whether or not we fully mitigate that added burden and cost, and we discussed that in a different report. So again, I think we'll raise that same issue on what kind of secondary burden do we impose on other taxpayers as we put a conservation easement on parcels and potentially reduce the value of that land and therefore shift some tax burden to other taxpayers. But frankly, the assumption that a conservation easement reduces the value of the land on which a conservation is placed is, I think, open to question. And you will undoubtedly have a good discussion about that with tax assessors who are dealing with this more and more and quite uncertain that assumption is always true.
I will wait for a couple weeks.
Right. We all will. Okay. Any other questions of the team? Okay. Thank you very much. Always very informative, and we look forward to your next reports. The next item on the agenda was called either updates or responses from audited entities wishing to comment. We didn't contact or, you know, with anybody else who wants to tell us what they think we ought to do in the legacy committee. We didn't try and do a list. We didn't ask people specifically to testify or do a or make, you know, prepare testimony, but we just like to kind of continue this in the form of a conversation. Is there anyone, although the conversation has to be conducted from so that we get it on tape. Is there anyone who is either would like to make some comments on the auditor report or lacking that, any directions or thoughts about the legacy? We have somebody come. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Well, she's coming down. At the last meeting, you said that people that had ideas for legacy funding could just bring their idea and get on the agenda. Is there a process for doing that? I've had three contacts.
Yes. yes. Talk to
is
Michael.
There
yeah. Well, what we're doing, you know, you see, we've done our next, we've set up the next meeting, and we've set up the meeting after that. We may do a meeting specifically for that.
Okay.
But But they should go to Michael and get on a list, or Krista and get on a list. Either one, not me. I mean, if they want to reliably get on a list, don't go to me. Go to one of those two.
Yes. Have a conversation.
Okay. Representative Pazman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, I have heard in another conversation that you're not expecting bills necessarily to be introduced.
Right.
Is your intention that you will ultimately shape a bill that will be the committee's bill?
Yes. And I, if people prefer, and what we'll do, which I admit we haven't done first yet because we haven't gotten anything that needs to do, is that the purpose, one of the nice purposes of a bill is it makes something public. And so I think what we will clearly do is we will have a website that will make these proposals public as if they were a bill. And I ask people to think of, if you get the, you know, if you get the appropriation, it's going to be a paragraph or a line in a bill. Think about something that looks like that, but then with maybe subtext to tell us what it does. I'm just trying to eliminate the idea of greenbacks and yellowbacks and deadlines and getting them, particularly as we're hearing, you know, that there may be even more constraints on people offering bills and so forth. So I'm just trying to make it fit in with what we have to end up a little bit better. And if anyone wants to put in a bill for any reason, that's fine, too. We'll deal with it, too. We've also had an agreement that the, with, you know, because of some of the conflicts with Representative, not conflicts, but cooperation with Representative Wagenius' committee, that before we do, before we prepare a bill, it will go to Representative Wagenius' committee first, like, you know, as a formal bill. So her committee we'll look and see how it fits in with their stuff, and then it will come on. It helps having so many people on both committees so they can supposedly think in two directions at once at different times at the same time. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I'm capable of thinking two directions at once, but I'll try to stick to one. Okay. I'm just a little confused about just how this bill is going to be assembled. And which, you know, how, where will the bill originate, and who will make the decisions on what's in the bill?
The committee, as always does, will make those decisions, the final decision as to what's in the bill. What kind of preliminary bill you get will probably originate from, some of it will be from Representative Wagenius' committee. Some of it, you know, we'll figure it out as we go along. We'll tell you what you have to know. Don't worry.
When you need to know it.
I'm going to start thinking two directions at once here pretty quick.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. One, our Finance Committee, we will be hearing from each of the agencies during the month of February, and they will present the governor's bill and the governor's proposal or their ask for clean water. In that way, we'll be able to determine if we're substituting or supplanting. And I think that is one of the things that we can offer this committee, because we will hear that testimony and welcome anyone to those committee hearings. We have it all scheduled up through our ABLE committee administrator has set up all the hearings through February, so each of the accounts and all of those that will be accounts and all of those that will be agencies that will be asking for or using clean water money, it's all been set up. So welcome anybody to the committee.
And our ABLE committee administrator will keep close contact with Representative Wagenius' ABLE committee administrator. Okay. Sorry. Let's introduce yourself and say.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Naomi Munzner, the new director of the Office of Grants Management at the Department of Administration as of December 12th. The mission of the Office of Grants Management is to standardize, streamline, and improve state grant-making practices and to increase public information about state grant opportunities. I look forward to working with state agencies, current grantees, the nonprofit community, and the legislature. I'm responding to the audit issued October 25th, 2012. We appreciate the Office of the Legislative Auditor's work. The department agreed with the need for enhanced grant monitoring and financial reconciliation for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds. I understand that the office was in the process of developing an on-site monitoring and financial reconciliation schedule for state fiscal year 12 at the time the audit began. State fiscal year 12 on-site monitoring visits and financial reconciliation were completed in April and May of 2012. The office is currently developing a financial reconciliation and on-site monitoring schedule for this current fiscal year 13. In addition, all current fiscal year grant payments are reimbursement based. We also appreciate the Office of the Legislative Auditor asking the Office of Grants Management about grant policies and procedures at the audit exit meeting. The office works closely with the Grants Governance Committee. Committee membership includes state agency representatives and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I convened the first meeting of this committee last week, and we discussed grant policies and procedures. There is agreement on the need for continuing policy work in this area. State agencies additionally have the ability to request an exemption from specific policies. This process helps the office learn and understand the context, the challenges, and difficulties state agencies experience with implementing certain policies. We look forward to working with state agencies, current grantees, the nonprofit community, and the legislature on grants management procedures that are effective and ensure that state funds are expended and managed appropriately.
Any questions? Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, could we have your name again, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Naomi Munsner.
S-O-R?
M-U-N-Z-N-E-R.
Do you have a question? Do you have a question?
No, mine's
a okay. Okay. Are there any other questions for Ms. Munsner? Okay. Representative Hausman, is this witness excused?
No, actually, probably to you. I mean,
that's what I just asked. Thank you very much. That
thank
was a nice, concise
statement.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of I don't know, questions or observations, and they are not for today, but it's sort of in listening to the audits, you know, this is new, and we were heading in a particular direction, but the couple of things that are sort of troubling me, this is a legacy committee, and that usually means we leave a legacy. And the question is, do we leave a legacy by doing a lot of things or a few things really well? In other words, leaving a legacy. And it comes out of the discussions of the need for oversight. And, you know, as regrettable as it is, something brand new that has no track record, it does need a lot of oversight. We don't know who in the heck they are and what they're going to do and whether they are going to do what they promise. If you have established institutions with a long history, respected and proven partners, by the nature of that, they need less of that because there is a record of an honest approach to things. And so that's something that's sort of really I'm debating in my mind. The other is the whole issue of money going through granting organizations. Because then the question of overhead, cost to administer, so now we're not directly going to partners, but we're establishing lots of groups who are going to administer or provide oversight. And so some of the money really gets diverted there. And I would contrast that to rather than direct appropriations, where a decision is made here and it goes directly to an organization. I mean, those are two issues that as we're getting a little bit of a track record here, that I'm beginning to struggle with.
Okay. Well, I think one of my thoughts on it, which is nothing more than my thoughts as one member of this committee, are specifically that I don't think we really want a very rigid path to set on. I think we're going to see successes in many different directions, and I think we should be a little bit totally agreeing with everything the auditor said, we ought to be a little bit flexible as to what our structure is. I was on, I guess, an ad hoc member of the first year, but I haven't been on it for the last two. But my thoughts of looking at it very much as an outsider is that there are a couple of directions I'd like to move us in where we haven't been before. Oh, we haven't been as thoroughly as I'd like it to. One, I'm not sure that this appropriation has served underserved groups as well as it should. And that I mean by Native American groups, African American groups, Somali, Hmong, Latino, and children, too. I mean, I'm not sure how much of what we do is thinks about benefiting children. So I'd like to see, and it doesn't mean that I want to fund inferior projects that or projects that can't meet the kind of oversight from those groups, but I'd like to see an encouragement from the kind of groups that don't usually hire big lobbyists and don't usually, don't interact with us the way so many of the groups we're used to interacting with do, get their say in this committee. So that's one of the things. I think one of the things I'd also like to see is a sense of connectedness. Let's just do it. The easiest way to think about this is trails. I'm much more interested in a trail that will connect two pieces of existing trails than in a totally new trail somewhere that's going to be separate all by itself. It's also true in terms of acquisition of lands and so forth. I'd like to see something that's going to be part of a multi-purpose kind of thing, then again, something that might just be a little patch that only one set of people are interested in. Do I have things that I'm blaming or things I'm saying that weren't good? No, but I'm just saying that this is a direction I would like to go in. And you're all welcome to add your opinions, to put negative or positive comments on what I say or anything, but I think this is only when you think of the length of the history of the state and the history of general appropriations of the state, this is a pretty new process. I mean, it's similar to other processes that we've had, like the Environmental Trust Fund, but I think it's evolving, and I think we shouldn't be too rigid in the way we stop it from evolving. So that's nothing more than my opinion. Is there anyone else from the audience? We're just about ready to stop. Anyone else from the audience want to make any comments on either the audit or the direction of the legacy? You'll have other opportunities. You don't have to do it just today. The direction of the legacy committee or anything? Any members want to say anything? Not today. Okay. The meeting is adjourned.